Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Can't wait for tomorrow. There's a number of stories on Islam and Syria that will be ideal to share and talk about with IQ al-Rasuli. But right now, what I would like to do is to share what Yahweh had to say about his Torah. If you recall in our previous programs, Yahweh had just encouraged Abraham to refer to his wife Sarai by a different name, a name that conveys a great deal about the nature of our spiritual mother, the set-apart spirit in the covenant, and the role that she plays, so that we can understand who the spirit is and what she provides. And so she went from being called princess, that's a cute little name, right? Princess, to Sarah. And Sarah in Hebrew means to engage and to endure, to be set free and to be empowered. That's the role that the set-apart spirit, our spiritual mother, plays in the lives of the covenant's children. And then, if you recall, after that, Abraham was told that Sarah is going to be used, that through Sarah, Yahweh is going to bless everyone on earth, Goyim, no matter the race, no matter the place that they hail from. It's going to be his means. She is going to be his means to advance his heart's desire, which is the covenant, the ultimate means of God, where he says he's going to get down on his knees to lift us up through what she represents. And if you recall, Abraham then fell down on his face laughing. And says, come on, God, that's silly. You know, I'm 100 years old. My wife is 90. This is getting to be ridiculous. No way. Mocking God, laughing at God. And yet, God took this in stride. He said, you know, my goal here is to establish a relationship with my creation, with humanity. And I'm not going to respond as a father by punishing Abraham for mocking me, for laughing at my face, for not trusting me. I'm instead going to work with him. And so God said, come on, stand up. Let's, here's the reality. I'm telling you that your wife's going to have a child, and I'm going to expand my covenant through that child. And, oh, by the way, since you were all so giddy and laughing, you're going to call the first child of the covenant Yishak, which is the Hebrew word for laughter. And then Abraham even said, I got this idea, God. How about my idea? How about my plan? This is kind of like Christians saying through Paul, you know, God, your plan doesn't seem realistic to me. I don't really like your plan all that much. So how about my plan? And Abraham's plan was Yishak, or Ishmael, which was, you know, that was Hagar's child. And Sarai, back when she was the princess, told Abraham, you know, maybe we can work this out and we can have an heir through the slave girl, Hagar. And so Abraham says, how about him? That's my idea, God. That'll work. You know, we'll get this all resolved. We'll move on. Just a little modification to your family covenant thing, to your marriage vow idea. Just a little modification. Let's do it my way. And you recall that God said, absolutely not. No way. Ishmael is not going to be restored to my presence. He's not going to live with me. No. Absolutely not. I won't even consider it. Tells you how compromising Yahweh is going to be when it comes to the conditions that he has established for participation in his covenant. And so he says, Sarah, your wife, she shall deliver a child to be your son, and you shall call his name accordingly Yishak, which means laughter. And God says, and I'm going to stand up and establish accordingly my family-oriented covenant relationship with him for the purpose of an eternal and everlasting family-oriented relationship with and on behalf of his offspring after him. What can we discern from this? A, that God himself is going to take a stand, that he's going to establish his covenant, his family-oriented covenant relationship. Kum. You know, we talked about yesterday, the old campfire song. Kumbaya. Kumbaya. It means stand with Yahweh. Kumbaya. God's going to take a stand. He himself is going to establish his covenant. So, here's God making it really clear that if you want to be part of the covenant, if you want the benefit of being part of his family, it's because of the things that Yahweh himself has done on our behalf. What did Yahweh do? He articulated the Torah's guidance, and then he led his children away from human religious and political oppression into his home, the Promised Land. And he did so in a celebration of Pesach, Passover, Matzah, unyeasted bread, Bukurim, firstborn children, and Shavuah, which is the celebration of the promise of seven when he revealed his Torah to us. So I shall stand up and establish Kum accordingly, Eth, my covenant, my family-oriented covenant relationship, Bereth. This says that the covenant is Yahweh's. It's not the Old Testament. It's not the Old Covenant. It's Yahweh's covenant. My covenant, he says. And we know that Bereth is based upon the Hebrew word Beyeth. Beyeth is the Hebrew word for family and home. It's not hard to define because it's based on the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Beyeth, which is drawn to depict a home with a single entrance. And so the covenant is based upon home and family. There's one way in. And it is Yahweh's. It isn't Jewish. It isn't old. It hasn't been replaced. There is one of them. That's the third thing we can learn. And I will stand up and establish, one, accordingly, my family-oriented covenant relationship, two and three. It's a family-oriented relationship, and it belongs to Yahweh. With him. With whom? With laughter. With Yishak. God delivers the benefits of his covenant and enjoys and promotes it with us, with people. God could do everything all by himself, but then he wouldn't have a relationship, would he? No. Yahweh established his covenant with Abraham, with Sarah. And he has made it really clear that women are as important as men in this regard, because he went on and on and on talking about how he was going to engage and to bless the world through Sarah. You know, in a marriage, while there are distinctions between the roles of mothers and fathers and husbands and wives, one is not to serve the other. One is not to be lorded over by the other. That Christian view of husbands lord over their wives is from Paul's poison pen. Yahweh has made it really clear that his covenant's benefits come through Sarah. She represents the set-apart spirit. And that everything that is being done in this covenant, through this covenant, is with us. Eth. With us. In a personal association. God could have said, you know, I'm going to go do this and I'm going to do everything. If you want to be a part of it, so be it. I don't really care if you are or not. And I'm going to do all of this on my own. But then what would the purpose be of the relationship? What would the benefit be for God? You know, relationships require both of us, both parties to engage. And the advancement of the covenant is done with us, through us, along with us. And then he says, for the purpose of law, an eternal and everlasting family-oriented covenant relationship. Olam Bereth. So how long was this one and only covenant to last? Well, Paul says that it lasted only until his Jesus Christ came along and annulled it. Well, that's not what God says. And Yahusha was the living manifestation of Yahweh. So Yahweh here is saying in his Torah, right in the first book of the Torah, as he is establishing his covenant, that his covenant is always singular and absolute. But he's calling it eternal and everlasting, never ending, always enduring. Olam Bereth. That, folks, means there cannot be a New Testament based on a new covenant. That means that Paul's letters to the Galatians and Paul's letters to the Romans are deceitful, unreliable, untrustworthy, invalid, misleading, wrong, false. That's what this means. Now, if you're not capable of processing that information, I hope that you develop the ability to think rationally before it's too late. Christianity as a religion is completely incompatible with this statement. The one and only covenant is eternal and everlasting. And it's on behalf of Yishak of laughter and of his offspring after him. The offspring of the covenant comes by two ways, and Yahweh has delineated it twice in his previous statements during this, the fourth meeting with Abraham. The two beneficiaries of the covenant are those who are naturally born, the offspring and direct descendants of Abraham and Yishak and Jacob, but also those of us who choose to participate in the covenant, those who are adopted into the covenant, who are born in foreign lands with different ancestry, but who have made this choice and who yearn to be part of the family. Those are the descendants after him. Powerful statements. Marvelous insights. Now, as we move on, we're going to consider what God had to say in his about participation in his covenant. One at a time. We're going to look at each of the five terms and conditions of the covenant as they were presented by Yahweh himself, and it's his covenant. Since the covenant is more important to Yahweh than the rest of the universe and everything that's in it, since it is the very reason we exist, since it encapsulates God's promise to his creation, let's review its lone prerequisite, its four requirements, its instructional insights, its answers, its benefits, and its promises. To set the stage, the Torah says that Yahweh asked Abram to walk away from the land of his birth in Ur of the Chaldeans. Chaldeans is the scriptural name for the combination of Babylon, which is from Babel, meaning corruption and confusion, and Assyria, although Ur was for a period of time the city-state capital of Sumer. And so Sumer is the oldest known civilization. It's the birthplace of religion and politics, followed by first Babylon, Assyria, second Babylon, et al. This whole Chaldean concept is just the melting pot and birthplace of religion and politics and militarism and financial scheming that grew up between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in Mesopotamia. And the universal catchphrase for it is Babylon. And although Babylon only existed as a nation for a very short while, the Babylonians and the Assyrians, you know, were essentially the same people living in the same place, and they had there were Babylonian kings over the Assyrians and Assyrian kings over the Babylonians, but they There is a place, and we're going to get to their history, because I'm going to do, once we're finished with the covenant, I'm going to do a whole series of shows on Yeshaya 17 and 18, where Yahweh is explicit, tells us exactly how we're going to go from the Syrian war through a treaty that dissects Israel, and ultimately what's going to happen in terms of marauding hordes of terrorists, of Muslims following that, and specifically what's going to happen in the United States, and how the United States' behavior is so inappropriate in this regard. So we're going to do that, and in that I'm going to have the opportunity to share with you the Babylonian and the Syrian history. But for now, just when God says that he was in the land of his birth, Ur of the Chaldeans, that means Babylon. And Babylon represents more than just the nation. Yahweh goes to great lengths to describe Babylon and through his prophet Yeshaya, Isaiah, and he associates Hasatan, Halel ben Shakar, the adversary, with Babylon and Yeshaya. And in Yirmiyah, which is Yah's prophetic statement to Gentiles, he talks about Babylon being the corruptive influence of religion and politics and militarism. Babylon's bad. That's the religion, the politics, the militarism of man. The first hour of the show is all about exposing and condemning those influences in our lives, encouraging people to disassociate from them. So Abraham was in the land of his birth, of Ur of the Chaldeans, Babylon. So, prerequisite one. Choose to actually walk away from and literally come out of Babel, which is national, societal, religious, and political corruption, and family allegiances and customs. As a result, you will be able to live with God in the realm that he will provide. Here's Yahweh's statement. Yahweh said to Abram, I would like you of your own accord to literally walk away from and genuinely come out of your country, the land of Babylon, the realm of confusion and corruption, and away from your relatives, and away from your father's home and household, to God's realm, which is a result of the relationship and as a blessing. I will show you, and I will provide. Bereshit 12:1. So that's the first requirement. Let's call it a prerequisite of the covenant. If you want to engage in the covenant relationship with Yahweh, you will need to walk away from and disassociate yourself from all things Babel. That's the influence of patriotism, politics, religion, militarism. That's what you need to walk away from. If you're not willing to disassociate from those things, which is your choice, this is all of your own volition. And if you choose not to disassociate from those things, that is your option. You have your life. You have free will. You can do so. It's just that you can't engage in a relationship with God. You cannot be religious and know God. You cannot be religious and be engaged in a relationship with God. You cannot enter heaven if you are religious or political. It's a choice. You can choose one or the other, or even neither, but you can't have all. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. So the prerequisite of the covenant means that you cannot be religious and have a relationship with God. And since the only way to be saved is to be engaged in a relationship with God, you cannot be saved and be religious. So rather than religions providing multiple paths to God and religion providing a means to salvation, God is the antithesis of that. If you're religious, you're precluded from relationship. You're precluded from salvation. You have to be willing to walk away from it. Now, the same thing is true because Babylon wasn't just religious corruption. It was also political corruption, and it was economic corruption, and it was military corruption. And so all of these things count. If you are a patriot and you think that your military is providing your freedom and you're celebrating that, if you sing the national anthem with your hand over your heart, if you pledge allegiance to the flag, if you honor returning troops, then you're excluded. Just all there is to it. If you're not willing to walk away from those things, you're not welcome into God's home. Now, you might say that's intolerant of him. It is. Now, you might say it's unfair of him. No, it's not. He's given us free will, and he's given us the opportunity here in this mortal life to be as religious as we want, to be as political as we want, to be as militaristic as we want. And look at the mess we've made. You know, life on Earth is becoming hellish. Look at Syria. Look at the Ukraine. Look right now at Venezuela. Look at what's happening in Turkey, in Egypt, in Libya, throughout northern Africa. And we told the story from Nigeria today. Look what we have done to ourselves with religion, with politics, with militarism. Look at the mess that we've made. Would you want those same conditions to exist in eternity in God's home? How would heaven be any different than Earth if God allowed religion and politics and militarism and economic schemes into his home? Unless you're willing to walk away from these things, unless you actually want to disassociate with these things, you can't be welcome in heaven, because otherwise the rest of us in heaven would have to endure an eternity of all the things that have made life on this planet so vicious. Now, I don't want to miscommunicate here and think that not everything on Earth is counterproductive and vicious and deadly and destructive. Loving families are enormously beneficial. Loving families are enormously enjoyable. You know, there are things that we can do. Music, song, learning, discovery, coming to understand. There are so many things that we can do, that we can enjoy, that we can benefit from, that have every possible enjoyment associated with them, including having a relationship with you. There are positives, but man, when you look at human institutions, they're counterproductive, they're rotten. And God's saying, no way in the world am I going to allow that into my home. It's a prerequisite. Religions don't lead to God, they lead away from him. Your country is not reliable. You should not depend on it. So that's the prerequisite. Now, the first requirement is to come to know Yahweh and understand his instructions so that you can choose to trust him and rely on them. As a result of this thinking, Yahweh will consider you to be innocent and righteous. Here's his text. It comes from Barashith 15:6. And he completely, this is Abram, he completely trusted in and totally relied upon Yahweh. And so based upon this thinking and his plan, he decided as a result of this consideration to impute innocence and righteousness to him. Therefore, God is saying that the path to perfection, the path to vindication, is by way of the second codicil of the covenant, to trust and rely upon Yahweh. When you come to trust and rely upon Yahweh, Yahweh imputes, based upon this consideration, innocence and righteousness to us. Now, there is a aspect of this that you need to consider, and that is that you cannot trust someone you do not know, and you cannot rely on something that you do not understand. This is not about faith. This is not about belief. This is not about wishful thinking. To trust and rely, you have to come to know and understand. And there's only one place you can come to know Yahweh and understand what he's offering, and that is in his Torah. The only place he presents the terms and conditions of the covenant. The only place that he introduces himself to humankind. Now, these first two codicils of the covenant are related. When you transition away from a reliance on religion and politics and militarism for your salvation, if you will, for your freedom, to Yahweh, and you come to realize that what he is offering is liberating. It offers you great freedom. That it is the source of enrichment and empowerment. That you're transitioning away from a dependence upon government and religion to a reliance on Yahweh. They are the opposite. You can do one or the other. You cannot do both. But they are related. And God is saying here that if you do trust and rely upon him, he will consider you innocent and righteous. This is related to the third codicil of the covenant, the third requirement of the covenant. It is walk to God and become perfect, God said. And Yahweh appeared as God to Abram, and he said to him, I am God Almighty. Choose of your own volition to walk to my presence and come to be perfect. Bereshit 17:1. Now, there is only one path that Yahweh has delineated in his Torah. It's the path that begins with the doorway named Passover across the threshold of unyeasted bread, where we are perfected, and into his home as his children on Bukodim, adopted into the first family as the firstborn children, where then on the promise of Shabbat on seven sevens later, we are enriched with his Torah teaching, his guidance, and empowered by his Spirit. This then enables us to be troubadours, to teruah, to trumpet his message, to share his path, to issue a warning that all other paths lead away from him. On teruah, followed by Yom Kippurim, where Yahweh reconciles his relationship with Yisrael and with Yehuda, so that we can all camp out together on Sukkah with him in his home. That is the only path to God. That's the only path that he has provided, the only path to perfection. It is a path that is enabled when we come to know Yahweh and rely on what he has offered. And so that is why the third of five requirements to participate in the covenant is to walk to God along the path that he has provided, so that he can make us perfect. It means that the covenant's children observe the mikre, these invitations to be called out and to meet with God. Now, how do we do that? How do we come to know and rely on Yahweh? How do we come to walk to God and become perfect? Well, God explained it in the fourth requirement of the covenant. And God Almighty said to Abraham, and as for you, you should actually and continuously be observant, carefully examining and closely considering my family-oriented covenant relationship. You and your offspring after you throughout their generations, dwelling places, and eras of time. Bereshit 17:9. The way that we grow in God's family, the way that we come to know who Yahweh is and understand what he's offering, so that we can trust and rely upon him and his plan, so that we can walk to him and become perfect, so that we continue to disassociate ourselves with religion and politics, is by being observant. Yosha was Torah observant. God is encouraging us to be Torah observant, because there's only one place where you can carefully examine and closely consider the covenant. It's only presented in one place, in the Torah. In fact, in the first book of the Torah, it's the most important story of the Torah. It dominates the first book of the Torah, Bereshit, in the beginning. And so God's saying, you know, if this is what you choose, if you want to be part of my family, you're going to need to be observant. Now, there's a reason beyond the fact that by observing, we're not misled. And that's a huge thing. If you want to keep from being fooled by Christianity, if you want to keep from being fooled by Republican or Democratic politics, if you want to be kept from being fooled by the media, if you want to kept being fooled by judges, as was the case in our opening story today, the way to be immunized from being played for a fool, from being misled, is to be observant, particularly of what God has to say about his covenant in his Torah. That's the antidote for the corruption of this world. Now, there's a second aspect here, and that is that in eternity, what we're going to be doing is exploring. If you enjoy learning, if you enjoy understanding, if you find exploration to be fun, then you're going to love eternity. So if being observant, closely examining, carefully considering what God has offered, what he has created, is something that you find fun, enjoyable, beneficial, and you prioritize that, you're going to love heaven. You really are. But if you don't, if you're inclined instead just to believe, to put your faith in something you don't know or understand, if that is your inclination, you're to hate heaven. If you don't like learning, if you prefer to smoke weed or drink booze, and if your preference is to play video games all day long, and you've got every manner of priority, but learning isn't one of them. If this isn't what trips your trigger, you'd hate heaven. You know, heaven isn't just sitting around on comfy beds eating fancy food while you're being served and treated like you're a glutton. No, that's not what heaven's about. Heaven's about exploring the universe with the creator of the universe. I'm learning everything there is about life and about energy and about matter, and coming to know one another through these great voyages of discovery. We camp out in this massive universe together. So many things to see, so much to experience, so much to do, so much to learn, so much to understand. And that's all of eternity. If you like those things, you're going to love heaven. If you don't, you ought not go there, because you're going to ruin it for the rest of us. We'll return to Shattering Myths in the final segment after the commercial break. There aren't just four terms and conditions of the covenant. There are five. We have five fingers on our hands. There are five benefits to the covenant. There are five conditions of the covenant. There's five fingers on our hands. There are five hands in Yahweh's name. For those who've listened to this program, you know that Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh, the two Heys, have two people standing, their hands are reaching up to God. The Heh is from Henna, and in Hebrew it means to be observant, to pay attention. And so the two people standing in Yahweh's name are indicative of Abraham and Sarah, the father and mother of the covenant, husband and wife, mother and father, standing up, reaching up to God. In between them is the wall, which is the drawn by way of a tent peg. And by the way, those two people are standing. They're not bowed down. And that tent peg is the symbol of enlarging and securing a home and adding to those people. The Hebrew wah is the letter, and the wah means and, to increase, to add to. Of course, the first letter in Yahweh's name is the Hebrew word for hand. It's a yod. It used to be called a yad. And the Hebrew word for hand is the name of the letter. And it's drawn with an upper arm reaching down and a forearm reaching out with an open hand. Yahweh's name begins with hand, and it has five hands in it. There are five benefits of the covenant. There are five conditions to participate in the covenant. We were designed with hands that mimic that convey that. In fact, two hands. Five fingers for the conditions of the covenant, five benefits, another hand for the five benefits of the covenant. The fifth, then, is raise your children within the covenant, circumcising your sons so that they and you always remember it. Yahweh stated it this way: this one and only family covenant relationship of mine, which is relationally, you should actually and continuously observe, carefully and closely considering, as a means to recognize me, as a source of understanding with regard to an association with me, and between you, to help you think, and between your offspring, so that they might be observant and responsive following you, for you to actually circumcise accordingly your every male, so that they remember. So God is asking us as parents to express our commitment to raise our children in the covenant, to circumcise our sons so that we remember, so that they remember, as a means to help us understand what Yahweh was offering. And, you know, it's a very interesting thing in that God asked us as parents to circumcise our sons on the eighth day when it's the single healthiest time in a person's entire lifetime to do this. It's the time that blood coagulates the most readily, meaning that the minor procedure is healed most expeditiously. And God never tells you how much you have to cut off. There's no procedure to do it. It's certainly not a religious ceremony. It just says, I want you to be circumcised. As we have learned, circumcised males almost never get cancer in their privates. And they almost never pass on cancer to their wives. It is also that a circumcised man is much less prone to many forms of venereal disease, are less prone also to passing it on to their wives. It is a beneficial thing, but God is trying to say beyond just the benefit of this that the whole covenant is about cutting, about separating, about choosing which side of the line of this cut you're going to be on. Are you going to be cut into the covenant and established within the covenant, or cut out of the covenant, is what he's trying to say. And since the covenant is about children and being in a family and conceiving and raising children, then the item being cut is the part of the male anatomy responsible for conceiving children. It's the perfect symbol. God calls it the symbol of his covenant. It helps us understand the very nature of this family-oriented covenant relationship and of being children born into this relationship, of being then nurtured and cared for by our parents. And man is certainly preoccupied with that appendage. And so it is a place where man is going to understand, this is important, this is a priority of my life, I need to remember this, particularly as I use this particular appendage to, in my home, in my marriage with my wife. It is an important symbol that helps us when we bathe our children to understand that we are committing to raise our children to be God's children in this covenant. Those are the conditions of the covenant. I hope you embrace them.